Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you for being with us here at The World. We are well aware of all the competition for your time and attention, and we are grateful that we are your source for global news. We hope that you find our work clarifying and believe like we do that independent, fact-based journalism is essential for democracy and can help us all gain perspective and make sense out of the noise. We're able to bring you critical reporting on international events because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 14th, we are fundraising with a goal of $25,000. Every gift counts and helps us cover the costs, from reporting trips and keeping our team safe to maintaining audio equipment, all so we can focus on sharing stories from around the world with nuance and with care. We hope you'll consider creating a monthly donation and joining the listeners who help sustain our newsroom year-round. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to contribute. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with The World. Now, on to the show.
An armed resistance is making gains in Myanmar. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, a general who left Myanmar's army says the regime is on edge.
The leaders are very demoralized. Honestly, they will probably fall apart if they don't do something different.
And in Haiti, an outcry over reports that a new leader was selected without democratic input.
So where we are today is that they have now reversed themselves.
Also, a new observatory in Chile sets a record for the highest in the world, capable of capturing data about the origins of bodies in space.
This telescope is going to be especially dedicated to observe the formation of stars and the formation of planets.
And birds of a feather don't always flock together.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The military junta in Myanmar is losing control of the country. 3 years ago, the army quickly seized power by deposing the democratically elected government. The military was seen as undefeatable, too big and too brutal to remove from power. But an armed uprising made up of different ethnic groups has gradually, week by week, taken back vast amounts of territory.
The opposition says it will keep fighting until the entire country is free. How all of this looks from within Myanmar's secretive regime has been difficult to report. But the World Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen was able to speak with an officer from the junta who recently decided to switch to the other side.
Imagine you're in charge of a nation overrun with traitors. Now you and your compatriots must hold the country together through extreme violence. That is the mindset of a senior officer in Myanmar's military. Take it from one of their own.
The military regime thinks if the revolutionary forces succeed, that's the end of the military and the country itself. So they must fight to the death.
That is Lion, a major in Myanmar's military. Well, ex-major. He went AWOL 2 months ago. He told me his real name and battalion number, and we vetted him with the help of other Myanmar Army defectors. But since defectors are executed if caught, I'll be using his nickname. Lion was a signals officer, transmitting orders by radio to the front lines. He spent his days around colonels and generals.
The leaders are very demoralized by the battlefield losses. Honestly, they will probably fall apart if they don't do something different.
Myanmar's military is up against dozens of armed groups collectively called the resistance. They want to destroy the regime and rebuild a country that is freer and more equal to minorities, who make up one-third of the population and have long suffered military violence in their mountainous homelands. The country's majority ethnicity is Burmese, mostly living in the center of Myanmar, the heartland. Lion is ethnically Burmese, like most of the country, and practically all senior army officers. He says officers think their race deserves to rule. He also says they've always feared pro-democracy Burmese youth uniting with minorities to fight back with guns. But Gen Z Burmese are doing just that. Recent footage of resistance forces shooting up an army convoy near the border with Thailand. They are fighting for a border city called Miawari that brings in $1 billion per year to the military government. Myanmar also touches China, India, and Bangladesh, but most of those valuable border zones already belong to resistance groups.
Most of the border cities captured by the resistance, the regime has kind of stopped trying to get them back. They are just trying to gain control of Myawari near Thailand, but they are struggling.
The death toll of this conflict could be as high as 50,000 people, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, an independent monitoring group. It says one in six deaths are civilians, mostly killed by regime troops. The UN has documented airstrikes on schools and hospitals, and villages burned to the ground. Do troops feel guilty about this? Lion says, not really.
As a frontline soldier sees it, if someone shoots at them from a house, that whole village is a terrorist hideout. That includes the woman and the children. They are supporting the terrorists too. So no, soldiers will not feel guilty.
Video from a regime soldier's mobile phone, captured by the resistance and released last year by Radio Free Asia, shows troops boasting about war crimes. A man in army uniform, speaking Burmese, says, "I was told, Sergeant, cut these people into pieces and bury them." Lion says he is personally against these tactics. In fact, he's against military rule, period, and was always against the coup, even though he couldn't speak out. But he says, generally, troops just do whatever they're told. He says the military is like a caste system. Senior officers eat well and stay in air-conditioned rooms. Frontline troops survive on bowls of rice and vegetables, a little meat once a month if they're lucky.
They don't have the luxury to think about human rights. They are also forbidden from having outside contacts, so even their thoughts are restricted.
Most troops are also ethnically Burmese, from the heartland. And Lion says they will fight viciously to protect what is left. Others agree.
The military, of course, has lost a lot in the peripheries, but in the center of the country, its grip remains quite firm.
Morgan Michaels is a Singapore-based research fellow with the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He says at this rate, the military could end up running a much smaller rump state, just the heartland. But for now, he says, it is hard to imagine revolutionaries storming Naypyidaw, the fortress-like capital. Far more likely, he says, is fracturing from within.
The humiliation of these losses is causing instability within the higher echelons of the regime.
Morgan Michaels says this raises the potential for disgruntled generals to depose the military's commander, General Min Aung Hlaing.
And so if there's some attempt to remove him or sideline him and it goes poorly and that leads to internal chaos, then you could see some sort of internal implosion of the regime.
Lion, the ex-major, says there are whispers in the military about deposing Min Aung Hlaing. But be careful what you wish for, he says. The top officers criticizing the commander, they actually think he's not being brutal enough.
The younger wave of top officers, they want to fight hard. And if they can replace senior general Min Aung Hlaing, they will be even more inhumane.
Despite his privileged position in the military, Lion opted to get out before the fighting got worse. He would have escaped sooner, he says, but it took him 3 years to slip his family safely out of the country. Lion defected to a resistance platoon. He worried, they might hate me for what I've done, but they treated him like a brother.
Honestly, I still can't believe that I defected. It has not been easy jumping from the regime to the revolution side, but I'm going to make it work.
Lion is no longer an army major, but he hopes to remain a signals officer, working the radio, this time for the resistance. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
British Columbia is hitting the brakes on a bold experiment with drug policy.
This amendment will make public drug use illegal in British Columbia.
That's David Eby, the Premier of British Columbia, who has requested the move. Just 1 year after legalizing the possession of small amounts of hard drugs, this move amounts to a reversal.
The Canadian province had received federal permission to run a 3-year pilot project. It decriminalized drugs like heroin, fentanyl, and meth. The idea was to reduce the stigma of addiction and connect more people with recovery services. But there was a lot of public backlash, with even former and current drug users telling CBC TV that decriminalization went too far.
It's permission to do it wherever you want.
Everybody's like going, yeah, like we can do anything we want now. So if they thought they were helping them, they're actually, they hurt them 10 times more.
This week, Canada's federal minister for addictions and mental health said it's too early to draw conclusions about the decriminalization experiment. For more on this, we reached out to Mike Hager. He's a reporter with the Globe and Mail based in Vancouver, British Columbia.
The main goal was to stop arresting people for what politicians described as a health problem. So in that respect, it was a success. Arrests for simple charges of simple possession fell off a cliff after this was brought in. They really continued to fall. So that was a success. But then it gets murky in terms of tracking the success of this pilot project. And that's where the government here really ran into trouble justifying the project when people saw a lot of chaos in their communities. We had local mayors of bigger cities who all have huge populations grappling with poverty and inequality using substances in public. And that really turned people sour on this project, and then it became intensely politicized.
Mike, what did that chaos look like before things got politicized?
You had mayors of cities around this province complaining that people were now using more frequently in parks, beaches. People were fed up with having to go to the playground with their kids and see someone using in plain sight more brazenly after this project was announced.
To be clear, though, the policy reversal has been requested by British Columbia, but the federal government has said not yet. There's not enough evidence to stop the project. Is that right?
So they're not stopping the project. They're asking to roll back any sort of use in public, which is an exemption to our federal drug laws. They've asked for an exemption. They got that a year ago. And now our federal health agency is reviewing the request to once again make it criminal to use drugs in public.
I mean, it does seem right now the federal government and the provincial government disagree on whether it's too early to draw any conclusions from this experiment. Just based on your reporting and in your opinion, Mike, did British Columbia prematurely come to this conclusion, and was it the result of public outrage or real science?
I don't think you can divorce this major policy shift from the upcoming election here in the fall. So this became intensely political. The leadership of this province reckoned that it was untenable to continue at this rate with this election and continue governing the province. So, you know, the science in many ways can be spliced because there are so many variables. Of course, the biggest one being up to 7 people dying a day of fatal overdoses from illicit drugs. But right now, decriminalization as a project is very much up in the air. Like I said, we're going to watch what will happen to deaths after this move. But the other wrinkle is that the province has also announced that they are going to ramp up treatment options and improve connecting of people who overdose and go to hospital with wider kind of healthcare options after they're discharged. Because as it stands right now, people often overdose and then are released from hospital without much oversight. So the province is hoping that they can get a handle on these deaths by improving the wraparound services for folks who do overdose and do get sent to hospitals. So that is another area that the science will have to kind of develop and see how improving treatment in that space in hospitals will improve outcomes and hopefully reduce deaths.
Mike Hager there. He's a reporter with the Globe and Mail. He spoke to us from Vancouver. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Let's go now to the nation of Georgia in the Caucasus. And for that, we start in Turkey, where the Kura River has its headwaters. From there, it cuts eastward into Georgia, where the river is called the Matkwadi. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek recorded those icy waters in March of 2015. He was walking toward the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, at the time. And that actually is where he is right now. The city is currently in the grips of a political crisis over a Russia-inspired law that critics fear will stifle media freedom. Paul, good to have you back on the show with us. We'll get to the protests in a moment. Big news there that we've been covering. But let's talk first about Tbilisi, where you are. A bit of background on the city. Historically, what makes Tbilisi unique?
It's another one of these trading hubs, and it's like a fulcrum point that balances right between Europe and Asia. So this is where a lot of the Silk Road caravans came to, and they would unload their merchandise here, go take a steam bath in the hammam,
wow.
And then trade it on to Europe. So a kind of a marketplace society here where everybody was welcome.
You had been walking for nearly 2 years, nearly 3,000 miles out of East Africa when you reached Georgia in 2015. You kind of got stuck there, from what I understand, for months. How did you shift gears from visitor to basically resident?
Yeah, months and months. I was trying to get a visa to walk through Iran, because Iran, as you know, Mark, was a hugely important country in terms of just human culture, human migrations. And the weeks were ticking off, right? I was applying. I was thinking I'd be staying in Tbilisi only for, you know, maybe a few weeks. I ended up spending almost 9 months
wow.
waiting here. Iran was that important. Guess what? The visa did not come through. So I had to basically enjoy a lot of good wine here and got to know the Caucasus before heading into Central Asia instead.
One of your explorations in Georgia took you to a vineyard. Georgians claim to have invented winemaking. Is that national pride speaking, or is there something to it?
It's a little bit of both. It's a complicated thing. I don't want to offend my Georgian friends, right? It's really hard to go back 8,000 years, right? This is like early, almost Neolithic, right? This was even before the Bronze Age. There was no written language. But they found, you know, they found clay pots here. They've done scrapings inside, analyzed whatever residues, and it was grape juice, right? So I think Georgia has as good a claim as anybody. Maybe, you know, parts of Turkey, parts of the Caucasus. This area might have been the original vineyard of the world, for grape wine anyway. They're very proud of it.
I mean, you write about this vineyard where a previous owner, you describe as a Francophile, used to make champagne and it would flow in a fountain in the courtyard.
There was a great anecdote. I went to another vineyard when I was here, a small family vineyard, and the guy was like making beautiful wine. They make it, Georgian wine, as you may know, it specializes in kind of making out of a clay pot. They sink it into a ground. It's called a kvevri, and it has kind of an earthy flavor because of that. Very distinctive, right? And he said, you know, I went to Italy and I won this first prize award. And they said, hey, where have you been all these years? He said, guys, you know, we've been fighting the Russians. Give me a break.
Now, notably, Georgians have also been cultivating honeybees for thousands of years. You came across an archaeological dig, a burial site, where mummified bodies had been embalmed with honey. Tell us about that.
I got to actually go into the lab where they were analyzing some of these artifacts. We're talking 4,300 years old. This is like really beginning of the Bronze Age. These are kind of a semi-nomadic culture that was kind of using big ox carts. They had tamed oxen, but not horses yet. And they were kind of moving like in tented camps, you know, around the steppes, around the mountains of this part of the world. And the archaeologists found this very big mound that they dug into, and buried in it was some kind of a chieftain. There were apparently people who were slaves who had been sacrificed and who died along with him. But they and everything else in this burial chamber was preserved with honey. And you could smell, Marco, 4,000-year-old honey. You could smell the sweetness coming out of, they had like nuts and berries and pieces of basketry. And honey is an amazing preservative.
How did honey preserve the human body?
It's so sweet that bacteria can't survive in it because they consume all the oxygen and it becomes an anoxic environment. So like the bog people, right, that you've heard about in Scandinavia, people they pull out of these mud bogs, there's just no oxygen, so they don't decay. honey has kind of the same effect.
Right.
There's a legend even that Alexander the Great was buried in honey.
Incredible. Paul, you also wrote about Georgians' reverence for their nation's poets. What does that say about Georgian identity?
Yeah, I mean, they have an amazing, rich, very old lyric tradition here. It's equal to their pride in being kind of one of the first vineyards of the world. Their heroes, their national heroes are poets, Shota Rustavelli, Shaba Favela, Svach Favela, these names of these kind of iconic lyricists. And you can tell a lot about a society when you walk through its capital and you see who's up on the pedestals, who are immortalized in statuary, right? Many societies, it's kings, it's generals on horses with a saber pointing at the sky, right? Powerful people. In Georgia, it's often poets.
Now, the question of identity and free expression, it brings us to today. Georgian security forces cracked down on protesters outside parliament after lawmakers are coming close to approving this foreign agents bill. It seemed by many there as authoritarian and Russian-inspired. What are the people you've been speaking with saying about it?
What's happening here and what people here tell me on the streets, just last night, there were 85,000, 90,000 people marching in the streets against this bill. That the government says is for transparency purposes, right? The idea is with this bill, any kind of individual or institution that receives more than 20% of their funding from abroad has to kind of be registered. And the problem with that, that sounds like, you know, okay, that's just a transparency law. The problem with that is it has been weaponized in other countries, including in Russia, which the people on the streets down during the demonstration say that's even the language of this bill echoes the Russian bill that has been used to crack down on civil society. And indeed, there's an election later this year. There's a very important election coming in the autumn in Georgia.
Right.
And the opposition people, the citizens marching in the streets are saying it'll be very difficult to monitor and watchdog this election if this bill passes, right? Because all of us, the media, civil society groups, election watchdogs will suddenly have very intrusive government looking into what they're doing because of this registration process.
Well, Paul, I mean, you've read a lot about Georgian history. You were immersed in the country for nearly a year, as you explained. Put this current debate and conflict over the foreign agents bill into a historical context.
You know, looking at deep history, the Caucasus have always been a bridge. They've bridged two continents, you know, Europe and Asia. The northern steppe, the southern, you know, Mediterranean climates. And so yet again, this seems to be a tug of war for the country of Georgia about where its heart lies versus where geopolitics is trying to drag it. 80% of Georgians in the latest polls say that they favor integrating into the EU. The EU is saying that this new bill threatens Georgian integration. So there's a tension here between, I guess, elites, political elites, and ordinary people, between people who've had power here for a long time and those who don't. And it's just playing out. This is the latest iteration of a place that's both a crossroads for trade, but also a cockpit for competing power, right? In a very important part of the world.
Paul Salopek's project is the Out of Eden Walk. You can see photos of his walk through Georgia and from some of the many places he's already visited. It's all at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org, also at theworld.org. Paul, always great to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Likewise, Marco. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Running a successful business is rarely easy. It's about good ideas, timing, and staff. Sometimes it's also about paying off criminal gangs. As a small business owner in Peru explains, extortion has become more and more a regular part of life in that country. That story is still ahead here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Haiti's newly installed transitional council had one job above all else. It was supposed to choose someone to become the next Haitian prime minister. On Tuesday, four of the council's seven members announced their selection of Fritz Belazaire, a little-known former sports minister. That choice sparked a backlash from Haitians who saw the decision as a shady backroom deal. Late last night, council members announced they were reversing their decision. election. They're now saying they want to take another look at the potential candidates for prime minister. To help us sort through this political tug of war, we got in touch with Jacqueline Charles, the Miami Herald's Caribbean correspondent. She says political pressure forced the about-face by members of their transitional council.
So where we are today is that they have now reversed themselves. They've said that they are going to take a step back. They are going to return to the agreement that they signed on April 3rd, which lays out the step in which they will make a selection for a prime minister. So we still do not know if at the end of this, Billy Zier will still emerge as the winner, or will there be another selection? Because this voting bloc, they control 4 of the 7 votes on this council.
You know, I gather that many in Haiti see the council itself as a product of kind of a backroom deal, and them doing another backroom deal to name this prime minister, if just temporarily, you know, sets a troubling precedent. What would you say about how this transitional council has gotten its start?
Well, the start has not been good. I mean, this is the first crisis that this council now faces. And while they have made this decision after at least 2 of the groups basically, you know, denounced it and called for them to do the reversal, I don't think the crisis is actually over. We are seeing a lot of back and forth, a lot of accusations. And so we still have to see how this process is going to work itself out.
You said there were 2 groups that voiced their opposition. Is that why the council has reversed their decision?
Yes. So Famille Lavalas, which is the political party by former President Aristide, which has a representative on the council, as well as the Montana Accord, which also has a representative on the council, they immediately issue statements saying that they need to reverse their position. As a result of the announcement on Fritz Belizaire, this council was in danger of collapsing.
Do the events of this week tell you anything about who is actually, you know, pulling the puppet strings here, or who actually has power in this transitional council?
What's been clear in this week is what we've seen is that there have been a few figures that have emerged, and one of them is Moïse Jean-Charles, who is the leader of Petite Dessalines. I mean, he is a former presidential candidate. He's a former senator. Initially, he rejected the idea of joining this council, and then a few days later, he decided that he would join, and he has managed to build an alliance on this council with the former foreign minister and prime minister, Claude Joseph, and others on this council that have been close to the party of former President Michel Martelly.
So I'm wondering how Haiti's powerful gangs play into what has been happening this week. Were they supporting Belizaire's selection, or are they part of the faction pushing to reverse that selection?
Haiti gangs do not currently have a seat on this council. They have been demanding a seat in this transition. So far, we are not seeing any signs that they are going to get a seat. They have publicly spoken out against this transition. There was an attempt by gangs to invade a particular neighborhood of Port-au-Prince last night. The airport, the main seaport, remained closed. Port-au-Prince remains paralyzed. You know, the violence and the danger of more violence, it continues. So we are still watching that very closely. But right now, they are not part of the political negotiations or discussions that are taking place. At least publicly, we don't see that.
So the gangs that are in control of much of Haiti right now do not have an official seat on this council and are not publicly part of the selection process. But I'm wondering how much power they have behind the scenes and whether a transition could succeed without their support.
Well, that's a $1 million question. I mean, we really don't know. I mean, right now they are in control of Port-au-Prince. It's creating problems throughout the country because of the, you know, the issues with fuel, the issues with food. But that's what we're waiting to see. I mean, the international community has put a lot of stock on this transitional council, while others have said the main priority, the main issue is security. But there's a lot of focus on the politics. And so far, the politics are not working out very well.
Are international players, diplomats involved at this stage of the process, or is it really being driven by Haiti and this transitional council?
There has been a very hands-off on the part of the international community, much to the frustration of some people and probably to the applaud of others. I mean, we have not seen any official statements from either the United States, France, or Canada on this. You know, they have not been involved in the negotiations or the discussions. And so, you know, left to politicians' own devices, this is where we are today.
Jacqueline Charles covers the Caribbean region for the Miami Herald. She's been updating us on Haiti's leadership crisis.
Extortion, a crime in which something, often money, is obtained from someone using threats or force. Across Latin America, extortion cases are on the rise. Businesses, large and small, have been under pressure from criminal groups. It's also happening to transport companies and sometimes entire towns. In Peru, authorities have seen a fourfold increase in cases of extortion in the past couple of years. The World's Tibis Isaiah spoke with some victims of extortion in Lima. And a note, some of the people she spoke with did not want to share their full names out of fear of retribution.
When Julian opened a small fruit shop in Lima back in 2022, he put up a big sign with a phone number for customer support. He was hoping to get messages from potential clients, but instead what he got was death threats.
Son avisos de amenaza. Conocemos que tú tienes un negocio.
The text said, we know that you have a business, we know where you and your family are, and we need you to transfer us the equivalent of $1,300 every other week.
Necesitamos que nos des 5,000 soles cada 15 días.
Otherwise, you'll have to bear the consequences. Julian was getting messages like this every day, so he reached out to the police. They advised him not to send any money. But then he started talking to other business owners in the area.
A mí me han extorsionado, y otro decía, a mí también.
He learned that a lot of them had also been extorted and even kidnapped. Some were already paying these fees. Others didn't even want to discuss the matter. And everyone was terrified. One morning, when he was opening the shop, he found a bullet at the entrance with a handwritten note asking one more time for money. Days later, a masked man on a motorbike entered his business with a pistol, demanding what he described as a protection fee.
Y entonces tú tienes miedo, ¿no?
He got scared and began transferring the fee on the first day of every week for several months, until he finally decided to sell his business and move to his native city 300 miles away. This kind of story is becoming more and more common in Peru. The country's attorney general reported more than 22,000 extortion cases across the country last year. That's a five-fold increase in just 2 years. And the trend has continued into 2024, according to General Marco Antonio Conde Cuellar, director of criminal investigation at the Lima Police Department.
Y venimos capturando por lo menos entre 4 y 5 bandas de extorsionadores semanalmente.
We've been capturing between 4 and 5 criminal gangs linked to extortion every week in Lima, he said. The majority of the new cases are reported by small business owners. Many, like Julian, are forced to pay a protection fee. Others end up borrowing money from loan sharks who demand exorbitant interest rates. About 500,000 people in Peru carry this kind of debt, according to the National Association of Creditors. And the most common reason borrowers seek out the loans is to pay other debts.
Sin embargo, no son delincuentes profesionales ni especializados para cometer delitos.
General Cuellar says that many of these extorters are people with little to no criminal experience who are venturing into the extortion business because it's relatively easy to do and it's very lucrative.
It's hard to put any real estimate on how lucrative extortion can be, but it's a significant percentage of GDP of any country in Latin America.
That's Chris Dalby, director of World of Crime, a security think tank. He says extortion is not a flashy crime, and many times it doesn't get a high level of attention from the authorities.
A lot of it happens at a low level. A lot of it happens in a non-violent way. And authorities tend to be more focused on homicides, kidnappings, more flashy types of criminal activity.
But he says it's crucial to tackle extortion because it generally ends up leading to violent crime. General Cuellar from Lima's police says his office is committed to stopping extortion. But some business owners are not convinced.
Bueno, aquí es una tienda bastante variada.
Noemi Pacheco owns a small bodega close to where Julian's fruit shop used to be.
Sí, nosotros tenemos 17 cámaras.
She's got 17 surveillance cameras and organized with other business owners to hire a private security company because, she says, police are not enough.
Seguros no estamos. Como te puedes dar cuenta.
She says she hasn't been extorted yet, but it could happen at any moment. As extortions and predatory lending have skyrocketed across the Americas, debt has become a root cause of migration for tens of thousands of people in the region. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Lima, Peru.
It is not unusual for immigrants arriving in a new country to experience depression and anxiety, especially when they're seeking refuge from violence or missing family and friends. In the U.S., non-English-speaking immigrants may be especially reluctant to seek help because of language barriers, stigma around mental health, or both. From Salt Lake City, KUER reporter Ciara Hewlett reports on how therapists and organizations in Utah are trying to widen the circle of care.
Javier Morales first started having panic attacks when he was in junior high.
I remember telling my mom, she's like, oh, what should we do? I was like, I don't know. I was like, I have no idea.
He says the next step wasn't seeing a doctor or a therapist.
I distinctly remember telling myself, like, hey, you just really need to, like, control this. You really need to, like, manage this better.
Morales is now a therapist in Farmington. He says this happens a lot with children of immigrants like him. They take on a lot more responsibility than other kids.
My mom worked for a shampoo factory. She would tell me people didn't respect her, right? Because she spoke English with an accent. My dad always felt like he was being talked to in a very, like, discriminatory or racist way, right? When he was driving garbage trucks and stuff. So bringing that home, it was more like, hey, I'm really tired. And I had a really rough day, and we're just surviving right now.
And his parents didn't really know what to do when he did bring up his anxiety because mental health is talked about less in their community. There's a big stigma.
I don't really think the terms anxiety or depression are used very often. I think it's more like, I guess the word in Spanish would be like nervios, which means like your nerves. It's just my nerves. That's what's making me feel this way.
Morales has had clients who've had anxiety or panic attacks and gone to urgent care, not realizing what it was.
And that's like their first exposure to a doctor saying, you should consider talking to a therapist.
A 2021 national survey showed only 36% of Hispanic and Latino Americans received mental health treatment. Compare that to 52% of non-Hispanic whites. Here in Utah, Latino women are less likely to report poor mental health or get diagnosed. That's from a 2022 Utah Women in Leadership Project report. Another barrier to getting help is finding a place where people feel understood, not just in language, but also culturally.
Hi.
How are you?
The nonprofit Latino Behavioral Health Services isn't your usual mental health clinic. The waiting area has a kitchen, couches, and a big dining table, and bright maps of Spanish-speaking countries line the walls. Nata Choa gives me the tour.
It gives a living room vibe.
Sometimes people come in just to do homework, and support groups meet there to play games, eat dinner, and do service projects. Choa says it's intentionally warm and welcoming to ease visitors into care.
When someone comes in, it's como the saying, like, mi casa, tu casa.
He started out as a client himself.
I know that when I come in the door, like, I'm not going to be criticized for being queer or for being Latino or for speaking Spanish.
To further break down the stigma, the clinic emphasizes a unique model, peer support. Choa is now director of that program, and it really helped him when he was getting treatment.
It helps me to know that I'm not alone. I think the unique characteristic of a peer support is that they can share their own story.
Olimpia Canizal is also a client turned employee at the clinic.
Para mí era maravilloso porque yo sabía que alguien podía salir de donde estaba porque había.
She says it was wonderful to connect with someone there who overcame depression. It taught her how she could too. It was also important to her that she was able to express herself in Spanish, her first language. But Latino behavioral health has long wait times, 3 months for youth peer supports. There's a high need in part because even those who speak English often like to see someone who is also Latino. Amanda Martinez is director of operations.
a lot of the Latino community are going through immigration trauma, and white people don't know what that's like. And so it's really hard to communicate or to connect with people who might not have any knowledge of what immigration trauma is.
And that trauma can be passed down to the next generation. Martinez says Latino Behavioral Health is trying to raise awareness so people will know where to turn for help.
We're always trying to find spaces where Latino communities are and be there with a table, right?
They have clinics around the state, and they're now going once a month to rural areas like Moab and Price, where the stigma is even greater. Canizal has seen lives change as she's given peer support.
Tú ves como al cliente cómo se iluminan sus ojos y
through that connection with someone in their community, she says they gain hope and believe they can heal. For the world, Ciara Hewlett, Salt Lake City.
It turns out birds of a feather don't always flock together. That is one takeaway from a recent study on migratory storks, anyway.
These storks fly from Europe to Africa and back again each year. They fly in very visible groups. But it turns out this survival tactic is just something that younger storks are into. The older ones, who've had plenty of time to learn the route, are happy to do it alone. They prioritize routes with good flying conditions over the security of flying with other birds.
To understand how age influences migration, researchers monitored about 150 storks over several years. The experts also concluded that older storks are just not as influenced by social pressures.
Just ahead, a better view into space. One country in South America is particularly well-suited for astronomy. That's largely because of its geography. More about the highest astronomical site on Earth in a moment. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Our next story deserves a superlative. It's about the highest altitude space observatory in the world. The Tokyo Atacama Observatory is not actually in Japan. Atacama is the clue that it's in Chile, sitting at nearly 19,000 feet above sea level at the summit of the Cerro Chajnantor Mountain. The observatory just opened. To find out more, we got in touch with Luis Chavarria. He's a Chilean astronomer with the European Southern Observatory, also in Chile. I asked him what astronomers were hoping to learn from this new observatory.
Well, there are two main topics that we want to investigate with this telescope. On the one side is, since the universe is expanding, the galaxies are moving away from us. And if the galaxies are moving away from us, they look a little bit red in color. And at some point, the galaxies that are located super, super far away, they look so red that we cannot see them with our own eyes. But the light of those galaxies, we can see them in something that we call the infrared light, which is something that this telescope is going to be specially equipped to capture. Okay. On the other hand, this telescope is going to be especially dedicated to observe the formation of stars and the formation of planets. How planets, hopefully planets like Earth, are being formed or being born.
Wow, so a lot of information and data with this new observatory. Describe the location of this observatory. It is very high.
It is very high. It is almost 19,000 feet. It's like being on the top of the world. It is a place that is not very, let's say, friendly for humans. We do have to bring oxygen.
That high?
Yeah, it's that high because you cannot breathe very well. You have to pass a medical exam before going up there.
Wow.
But it's very amazing.
Yes. So when will you be able to go to this newest telescope at the top of the Cerro Chajnantor Mountain?
Well, right now the telescope is almost finished. People at Tau, they expect to begin the first observations, hopefully at the end of this year. But this is not a place that you can just go up and visit. Okay, there are not visits to this telescope because, as I mentioned, you have to pass a medical exam. So it's only people that has experience working at high altitude, the ones that can actually go to the telescope. But we are going to be able to know about the beautiful science that they're going to do, the beautiful science, and to try to understand a little bit more about, you know, how the first galaxies were formed in the universe. So this is what we're looking forward to see in the next years with Tau.
Yes. So is there like a full-time caretaker at this new observatory?
Yes, they do have the people, not 24 hours. They do visit the observatory at the beginning. They're going to have people doing all the observations there, but probably they're going to have some control room, not at the super high altitude, but a little bit lower. So it's not so tough for the people that has to go there every day.
So there seem to be a lot of observatories in Chile. You were mentioning that earlier. What makes the country such a great location?
Well, it is the geography of the country. At that latitude, there are two chains of mountains that protect the observatories from the incoming clouds. From the ocean, we have the coast chain of mountains that prevents the clouds coming from the ocean entering the land. And then the other side is the Andes mountains, which prevent the clouds coming in from Argentina or Bolivia. If you add to that fact that the place is very dry, because it is clear skies almost, let's say, 80% or 90% of the days during the year, you don't have clouds in that area. And you have the best geography to observe the sky.
So, Luis, for those of us who are not at this observatory, but, you know, often look into the skies, tell us what you can see at this height in Chile without a telescope.
It is beautiful. I mean, I'm trying to remember my first time going to those sites where the observatories are located. And it is a little bit overwhelming because you go outside of the building, you wait maybe 1 minute so your eyes can adapt to the darkness. And then you see so many stars just with your naked eyes. So many stars that is overwhelming. You feel like that you are in the middle of an ocean, but an ocean of stars. And you kind of have this feeling of how small our planet, our existence is in the universe. So it could be even a little bit scary, but then you feel that you have everything at reach of your hand. It seems like you're going to, you know, you could grab the stars with your own hand. So it is a very emotional feeling, but it is beautiful. It is hard to stop thinking about that, about how immense is the universe and what is our role as a human race. What can we do from here, from Earth, in this little planet, looking at the stars? And, you know, how can we contribute to life on Earth from what we learn from the universe?
Luis Chavarria is a Chilean astronomer with the European Southern Observatory.
If you've ever wondered what your 75,000-year-old aunt might have looked like, and how could you not have thought about that, look no further than the University of Cambridge in the UK.
Based on the flattened, shattered remains of a skull found in Shanidar Cave in Iraqi Kurdistan, expert archaeologists and paleo artists spent a year working to complete a 3D model showing what this person's face would have looked like.
Some early clues suggest that they had likely uncovered a Neanderthal woman.
The most obvious one is this quite large brow ridge that runs across above the eyes.
Emma Pomeroy is a paleoanthropologist on the project.
But also things like the shape of the nose, so it's quite wide at the top. And also this part of the face, what we call the midface, is kind of puffed out. And that's a very Neanderthal characteristic as well.
The Shanidar Cave is famous among archaeologists. The remains of at least 10 Neanderthal men, women, and children were dug up there in the 1950s. This particular skull was part of an entire skeleton found at the cave, which is pretty extraordinary.
It included much of the upper body, the spine, shoulders, arms, and hands. That allowed scientists to determine that it was a she. Pomeroy says they've also figured out that she was pretty old when she died, for her time at least, well into her mid-40s.
Her teeth are extremely worn down. Some of these at the front. There's no crown left. By the time the teeth are getting this worn down, her chewing is not as effective as it would have been, so she's not able to eat in quite the same way. We've got some other indications of sort of poor dental health.
Yeah, the moral of the story, obviously, floss and brush.
Coming up tomorrow, we dive into the controversy over the Seine.
France has promised to clean up the famous river in time for this summer's Olympic swimming events is looking dicey. We'll have an update on what it will take to get the project across the finish line.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio.
And from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you tomorrow.
Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.